Welcome to What is Going Om for New Thought from the Edge of Om. Each week on Om Time's flagship radio show, veteran broadcaster, author, and media consultant Sandy Sedgbeer conducts thought-provoking interviews with inspirational authors, artists, musicians, scientists, speakers, and filmmakers who are working at the point where spirituality and science meet consciousness at the very edge of Om. Here is your host, Sandy Sedgbeer.
Do that then.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, thanks.
Hello. Food is undoubtedly one of the greatest pleasures in life. We all spend a good time thinking about it, preparing it, eating it, and then cleaning up afterwards. But how many of us have ever thought about the many activities associated with food as a spiritual practice? What if, instead of seeing these activities as chores, or engaging in them purely for pleasure, we could use them to increase our kindness and care, and as reminders of how we wish to live out the values that bring meaning to our lives. Venerable Thubten Chodron has been a Buddhist nun since 1977. She's been a close student of the Dalai Lama, with whom she's co-authored several books, and is founder and abbess of Sravasti Abbey, I have problems pronouncing that one, one of the first Tibetan Buddhist training monasteries for Western monks and nuns in America. Known for her warm, practical and humorous explanations of how to apply Buddhist teachings in daily life, Venerable Chodron joins us today to talk about her latest book, The Compassionate Kitchen, in which she shares some of the practices from the Buddhist tradition that help us make eating become part of our daily spiritual practice. Venerable Thubten Chodron, welcome to What is Going On.
Thank you, Sandy.
Now, you were born in Chicago in 1950 and you grew up near Los Angeles. You graduated with a BA in History from the University of California. And after travelling through Europe, North Africa and Asia for 18 months, you received a teaching credential and went to the University of Southern California to do postgraduate work in education. You also worked as an elementary teacher at the same time in the Los Angeles City school system. And then in 1975, you attended a meditation course, after which you went to Nepal to study and practice the Buddha's teachings. What did you find in Buddhism that took you away from your Los Angeles teaching career to become an ordained Buddhist nun?
Well, I was looking very much for meaning in my life, some long-term meaning, and I was asking a lot of questions about this. I thought meaning had something to do with helping other people, so that's why I went into education. But then when I went to a meditation course as in the summer vacation and encountered Buddhism, it really made sense to me. The teachers encouraged us to think about what they said, to test it out with logic and reasoning and see if it made sense, and also to test it out through, you know, the meditation practice and seeing if that helped us. So I did both of that, you know, looking at it through reasoning and also doing the practice, and I found it really made sense and it helped me quite a bit. And so I wanted to learn more. I had a very strong feeling that if I didn't learn more and about Buddhism, that at the end of my life I would have deep regret. So I quit my job and I went to Nepal and India, where these teachers were, because it was very difficult to encounter Buddhist teachings in English in the U.S. at that time. So I went back to Asia and spent time in the Tibetan community.
Had you had any, you know, religious upbringing particularly?
My family was Jewish. It wasn't very religious, but, you know, I had a spiritual upbringing. But it didn't really make sense to me. So I realized a lot of the ideas about a creator God, they make sense to other people, they help other people, but it just didn't resonate with me. However, I am very appreciative to my Jewish upbringing for teaching me good ethical conduct, and also the concept in Judaism of tikkun olam, to repair the world, to heal the world. And so that, you know, already had in me the ideas of love and compassion and service. And when I encountered Buddhism, Buddhism just really took off and showed me how to develop those qualities in a very practical way.
When you left America for Nepal, did you have any idea at that point that you may one day become a Buddhist nun, or were you just following your heart and seeing where it led?
Actually, after encountering the Buddha's teachings, I knew rather quickly that I wanted to ordain, which is very surprising. And now when I meet people who have that experience, I'm a little bit skeptical. Why so soon do you want to ordain? But with me, it's like I knew, and, you know, so I went to Asia, and after living there for a while in the monastery, then I requested my teacher for ordination.
Now, you've studied and trained all over the world, I mean, living and practicing Buddhism in India, Nepal, under the guidance of His Holiness the Dalai Lama and other Tibetan masters. You directed a spiritual program in Italy for 2 years, studied at a monastery in France, was a resident teacher at a Buddhist center in Singapore, and you spent 10 years as a resident teacher at Dharma Friendship Foundation in Seattle. You're one of the first generation of Western bhikshunis who brought the Buddha Dharma back to the USA. Tell me first, what is the Buddha Dharma?
The Buddha Dharma refers to the Buddhist teachings, yeah, the Buddhist doctrine. That's the meaning of the word.
Right. And you then went on to establish one of the, in fact, the first Tibetan Buddhist training monasteries for Western monks and nuns in America. What inspired that decision? Did you just wake up one morning and think, I'll start a monastery? Or was it a long thought out process?
Well, when I first went to Nepal, I was living at a monastery, and I like very much living in community. Of course, it has its challenges, but the Buddha set it up so that we live together and live in community, because that way you have a lot of support from your environment and from the people around you. And being one of the, you know, first generation of Tibetan monks and nuns, Westerners in the tradition, we didn't have any monasteries. Oh, there were Dharma centers, but the Dharma centers were geared towards the lay people and not towards a monastic way of life. So I always had this feeling of, you know, I just want to live in a monastic environment so that we can really practice according to our precepts and, you know, not have so much distraction. So, yeah, so I lived in various situations, you know, in Dharma centers. I lived alone. But all the time in my heart, I really wanted to start a community, because there isn't one, there wasn't one, and we need this for the Buddha Dharma to spread and prosper in the West, and to make it available for other people. And so that was kind of the inspiration to start a monastery.
So
let me tell you, if people had told me when I was 20 that I would be a nun and that I would start a monastery, I would have told them they were out of their mind. But, you know, our life often turns out to be very difficult, different than we had initially thought.
Absolutely. So what were the challenges that you had to face? I mean, it's the first one. You're a woman. Where were you going to find the property? How were you going to support it? You know, where was the money coming from? I mean, how did you deal with all that?
That was exactly what I went through, because there was no big organization behind me. It was, you know, I had been teaching in various places for a number of years, And of course, the students there supported me, but, you know, I didn't need very much. I wore the same clothes every day. I didn't wear makeup. I didn't go to the movies. I didn't drink, you know, so it was relatively easy to support me. But starting a monastery, you know, entailed purchasing property. So there was some money that I had saved up from offerings that I had received. And, you know, when we found the property, which was really gorgeous, and the owner offered to carry the mortgage for us, then, you know, I used that bit of savings and then just put out the word to other people, you know, that this is what we're doing and if they would like to join, you know, in supporting it. And miraculously, you know, we were able to get the property and then pay off the mortgage. So it's really, I think, due to the kindness of other people and the enthusiasm of other people, because they had encountered the Buddhist teachings, they had found the teachings useful in their life, and they wanted to help start a monastery.
You know, reading your book, The Compassionate Kitchen, which I found really interesting and enlightening, it seems to come across to me that you're the kind of person who really likes a challenge. You know, you pushed yourself all the way through to do things that perhaps are not expected. And I can imagine that you've just trotted out, you know, a very nice, neat explanation of how you came to found the Abbey. But I'm sure it wasn't that simple. I'm sure such an intimidating undertaking must have had its glitches, yes, along the way. But even when you got the Abbey and you started it, you then decided that you were going to challenge yourself even further by setting a rule that you were not going to purchase any food for yourselves, but instead would be relying on the generosity and offerings of others. Now, I know, because you tell in the book the story of the origin of the alms round or pindapat, where the monks would stand silently in front of a house with their alms bowl and await offerings. But tell us a little bit about that and why you decided to implement that at the Abbey.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so when Buddhism began in ancient India, there had already been a culture of wandering mendicants, spiritual people, who went, you know, who, when it was mealtime, went into the city with their bowls, and people would support them. And this is part of Indian culture and Indian tradition. So the Buddha's disciples did the same thing. And there's a few reasons behind doing this. First of all, it makes you very, very grateful to other people. And so you don't take your food for granted. You really appreciate that people are giving you food, that they are keeping you alive by the goodness of their heart, because they go to work every day and work hard to get the money or get the food, and then they're sharing it with you. So it really helps your spiritual practice, because you realize that you have a responsibility to practice well, to repay the kindness that you're receiving. So that's one reason that the Buddha set it up that way. The second reason was to cultivate satisfaction or contentment, because you eat just what people give you. So you don't go and say, you're giving me rice. I don't want rice. I want noodles, you know. Or you're giving me that. Oh, no, I can't take that. I want this. So it cuts out the pickiness and challenges us to be content with whatever people give. So, and you can see, you know, because I had lived alone for a while, and I knew that when I had money and had to go to the store to buy food, then of course, you know, I could get things I like, and I could go to the store whenever I wanted, whenever I had a craving for a certain food. But none of that was really good for my Dharma practice. And so, you know, in starting the monastery, I really wanted to go back to the idea that the Buddha had for his community. And although we, you know, it's a little bit difficult in the U.S. to go on Pindapot to walk with your alms bowl in town, we have some friends in California who did that. They had to get a parade permit from their local government because there were a group of monastics walking in a line. You know, Americans don't know what to do with this. It's not part of our culture. So I thought the best way to do it would be, you know, just to say that we'll only eat the food that people offer us. We won't go out and buy our own food. And so when I set the monastery up like this, people told me, you are crazy, you know, because we're out kind of in nature. We're not in the middle of a town. They said, you will starve to death. People will not bring you food. Come on now. And I said, well, let's just try it and see what happens. And when I arrived here to move in, people had already filled the refrigerator. There was only one time when we had finished the food in the refrigerator, but there was still some canned food. That was the lowest we ever got. And ever since, you know, ever since beginning, we haven't starved at all. And people have been incredibly generous with us. And I think this brings out the kindness in people. Because people, they come here, you know, we have retreats. We don't charge for the retreats. We depend on the food people bring to feed not only the community, but all the people who come here to study and meditate with us. And they come and they offer it, and they're very happy to make offerings like this. I think the being generous makes people's minds happy, yeah? And so doing it this way, people are generous to us and enables us to be generous in return. So we give all the teachings free of charge. We don't charge for things. And then in that way, everybody can, we have what we call an economy of generosity, where everybody feels good about being generous to others. Whereas, you know, if you charge people for things, then it's just business, and
yes,
that has no spiritual impact on people.
What a great model.
We love this, you know, economy of generosity.
You tell lovely stories in the book about how a newspaper came and did an interview with you in the early days, and after that people just responded, you know, people in the community just responded tremendously and very generously, bringing you food, and you've not really had any problems since. Is that always enough, or does it sometimes get a little bit low and you feel you've got to eke out what you've got?
No, we haven't had that. You know, there was that one time that I mentioned at the very beginning, but not since. You know, occasionally we'll run out of this or that, and that's just part of our practice, you know, to be content with what we have. So, okay, for a few days there's no fruit, or for a few days there's no salad. But then, you know, eventually some more comes, and it's okay. Yeah. So it's quite amazing. And, you know, from time to time, we have too much, and so we share it with the food bank, the local food bank.
That's wonderful. Now, what was your, I mean, you've written many, many books, and they've been translated into many languages. What was your motivation for writing this particular book?
This book, let's see. Well, first of all, I have to say, about writing in general, I never had the intention to write books. In college, my essays always came back marked up in red ink. So this was not my idea to do. But when I was in Singapore, people kept asking me similar questions, and so I thought, well, let's just do a little pamphlet for, you know, make it a Q&A booklet. And I did that, and that went well, and then people started asking me to write things. So in the case of this particular book, Because all the practices that are mentioned in here, we do at the Abbey. One day, well, over a period of days, actually, I was giving teachings on the meaning of these practices so that the monastics who live here know the meaning of the verses that they're chanting and they understand why we do what we do. And so these were videoed, and we have a YouTube channel. They were put on that. And then the idea came, well, let's just transcribe them and make them into a book. Because we have a lot of guests here, and they wanted to know how to take this practice of adding spiritual meaning to eating. They wanted to know how to take that home. And so that's how the idea for this book came about.
So in The Compassionate Kitchen, you talk about intention being the most important aspect of any action, and how this relates to our motivation for eating. Can you expand on that a bit for us?
Yeah. In Buddhist practice, our intention, our motivation, is what really determines the value of the action that we do. Okay? So it's not how we look to others and whether others praise us or blame us. Because we all know how to act phony and pull the wool over people's eyes and make them think we're better than we are. But in Buddhist practice, doing that is not spiritual practice. You know, our spiritual development does not depend on people praising us. So it depends on our motivation, our intention. Why are we doing what we do? And, you know, with this fast-moving world and with our senses always directed outwards towards, you know, the things and people in our environment, we so often don't really check up, you know, why am I doing what I'm doing? And so after a while, you'll see people in their lives, they'll be in the middle of a situation and they'll go, how in the world did I get myself in this situation? You know, why am I here? Why am I doing this? And so that's because we so often, you know, don't bother to think about what is really my motivation. We just act on impulse. So in spiritual practice, it kind of slows you down, and you have to really think, why am I doing what I'm doing? And so in terms of eating, you know, we have in the book the five contemplations that we do before we eat. And this really helps us set our intention for why we're eating and what, for the purpose of eating. And then having accepted the food, what our job is, what our responsibility is to repay the kindness of the people who offered it.
In stark contrast to what we're seeing in the world, where there's been an explosion of late in interest in cooking, in food preparation, in food competitions, food TV programs, and in the technology of food, you know, where now we have chefs who everything is created according to science. And clearly, all of these people, when we watch them on television, they love what they're doing. Many regard preparing food as a meditative practice, but the motivation, I'm not sure that the motivation, the intention, is the same intention as we're talking about in The Compassionate Kitchen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know other people's intentions, but I do know that it could be very easy to have the intention of producing something that is pleasurable, you know, sense pleasure for other people. There could be so many different kinds of motivations, and with TV programs, who knows, you know, why they're really doing it. But, you know, let me just tell you about the five contemplations that we think about before we eat, because this really sets the stage for the motivation. So the first thing we recite together is, I contemplate all the causes and conditions and the kindness of others by which I have received this food. So this is thinking about the causes and conditions of the food, the farmers, the people who transported the food, the people who prepared it, even, you know, what we did in our lives to be able to be to receive the food. And then also to contemplate the kindness of others. Like I said before, to really see, you know, people are going to work every day. They work hard. It's difficult in the modern society. And then out of the goodness of their heart, they share their food with us. So to really think about that before we eat. And then the second one is I contemplate my own practice, constantly trying to improve it. So this is really seeing our responsibility, you know, to look at our own practice, our own spiritual practice, and then to try and improve it, to better it, as a way of repaying the kindness of other people. In other words, not just taking food for granted, not just thinking, okay, well, it's lunchtime, what do we have, and I like this and I don't like that, you know. Instead of having that kind of attitude, really thinking about, you know, our responsibility in accepting and consuming the food. And then, and so this is already turning our mind, you know, so we're not just thinking about, oh, what's good, and, you know, do they have what I like, and am I able to get to the buffet before everything I like is gone, or is it all going to be gone before I get there? It's taking our mind away from all that grasping and self-centered attitude. Then the third contemplation is I contemplate my mind, cautiously guarding it from wrongdoing, greed, and other defilements. So when we're eating, to eat mindfully, to eat attentively, to keep our mind free from wrongdoing, and greed and other defilements. So, you know, the mind that is always saying, I like this, I don't like that, there's not enough protein, there's too many carbs, no, there's not enough carbs, you know, and whatever, you know, the way the mind is constantly dissatisfied. And so determining before we eat, you know, we're not going to give way to that kind of mind. And we're going to stay in a mind of cultivating contentment with what we have and of appreciation and gratitude. And then the fourth contemplation is I contemplate this food, treating it as wondrous medicine to nourish my body. Okay? So instead of seeing the food as, oh, this is good stuff, I'm going to, you know, inhale it and get it into my stomach as soon as possible. We're seeing it as medicine, you know, and it nourishes our body. And to really feel how what we eat affects our body and it affects our mind. I read the New York Times and there was an article entitled, Does What We Eat Affect Our Body? And I thought, oh my goodness, they have to ask that question? It's so clear that it does, you know? And what we eat affects our feelings, too. You know, if we eat very heavy food or very rich food, we often feel very heavy. If we don't eat a balanced diet, our body gets out of whack. So, you know, if we eat a lot of sugar, then we get the sugar highs and the sugar lows. So, you know, it's very clear that the food really is like medicine to us, and it affects our mental state and our spiritual state. And so to see it as that, and, you know, when we take medicine, we just realize, okay, I'm doing this to nourish my body. And so we don't get so hooked up into, you know, does this taste exactly the way I want it? Is this cooked exactly, you know, as much as I like it?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
then the last reflection is I contemplate the aim of Buddhahood accepting and consuming this food in order to accomplish it. And so here, you know, seeing that the causes and conditions for receiving the food, wanting, making the determination to keep our mind in a good state while we eat, and seeing the food as medicine, then we're thinking here, okay, when I accept it, then, you know, again, I have this responsibility to do my practice, and I'm aiming for a complete awakening or Buddhahood, and so I accept this food in order to sustain my body and mind so that I can accomplish the spiritual path. And I'm meditating and practicing the spiritual path so I can be of the greatest benefit to other living beings. So our practice is not just for ourselves. It's really to improve ourselves, gain new qualities so that we can really be of increased benefit to other living beings.
You also say that there are many aspects of this that apply to family life as well. Tell me about how we could introduce our children to mindful eating, how we could develop this as a practice at home.
Okay. Well, first of all, those five contemplations that I did, I think those are very suitable for a family to do. And, you know, what an incredible way if you have children, to get children thinking about the causes of the food, where their food came from, and all the people that were involved in growing and transporting and making the food. You know, because kids so often nowadays, you know, where you ask them, where does food come from? Well, you put, you know, some money in a machine and it comes out, or, you know, whatever. So to really get them to think about the whole process of growing and producing food and learn about the lives of people who do that. I think that's a really good thing for kids. We have one family that, you know, comes very often, well, several families that come very often to the Abbey. This particular one has young children. And so they get their kids involved in cutting the food and cooking the food and serving the food, and it's the kids love it. It's, you know, because little kids, they like to help. They want to help. They want to feel useful. So getting the kids involved in preparing the food, and I think that's a great thing for kids, because then when they go out on their own, in their teen years or early 20s, then they know how to take care of themselves and, you know, cook food themselves. Otherwise, you know, if the parents are doing everything for them, the kids go out on their own and then all they do is eat fast food because they don't know how to prepare their own food. Also, I think it's important for families to sit down and have time to talk together every day, and dinner time is a good time to do it. And people say, oh, I'm too busy and get home too late and da-da-da-da-da. But if you make it a real determination, because, you know, that the family's going to eat dinner together, because this is a really important element of our family life. We're not just a boarding house where we're all living in the same area and we bump into each other from time to time as we all do our own thing. But, you know, we're a family and we share the day. And so sitting down to eat and, you know, taking the time to really talk to your kids. Because I think very often parents feel rushed and, you know, they're always saying to their kids, you know, get dressed, brush your teeth, you know, do your homework. And, you know, that doesn't make a good relationship with your kids. You have to have time to sit down and say to your child, well, tell me about your friends. You know, what do you do with your friends? What do you talk about with your friends? Or what did you learn in school today? Or I know one family that goes around and in the evening when they eat dinner, they each say something that they learned that day, including the parents, you know, so that everybody is sharing how they're growing on a day-to-day basis. And so taking the time to have these kinds of conversations about what you're feeling, how, what you are seeing and experiencing, and what that means to you as a human being, even, you know, what you hear in the daily news and how that's affecting you, and, you know, to communicate with your family members about that. It's a wonderful kind of thing to do, starting when the kids are little and, you know, going through teenage years, because that way, when you do that, you're able to teach your kids values. If you don't have time to listen to your kids and what's going on in their lives, then there's no time to discuss how do you handle difficult situations, or what do you think about when somebody does this, or when this is going on in the world. And I think kids need that time to discuss things with their parents, so the parents can teach them values, and also so the kids can learn to think for themselves about what they consider is valuable and their ideas for how to handle situations. So I think, you know, all of this is really part of becoming close as a family, and for the parents and the kids to take some time out each day. And you remember the spiritual foundation of their life. I think that's incredibly important nowadays.
You share stories too of supporters who practice the Dharma at home with their families, and how it's in two particular cases they had an unhealthy relationship with food in the past, and how it actually helped them to balance their attitude. That must be very rewarding.
Yes, it's very rewarding, and that's why I included their stories in the book. You know, one woman who was anorexic, and, you know, and then when she really started to bring spirituality into her relationship with food, she was beginning to, she learned how to take care of herself, you know. And then the other man who told the story, he was, what did he say, he weighed 350 pounds when he was a teenager, something, you know, ghastly like that. And then he really began to see that his eating problem had a lot to do with how he felt about himself. And he's a real character and has a great sense of humor. So he started calling himself, his name is Bob, he started calling himself Bobby Sweetheart, you know, and giving himself some compassion, giving himself some empathy, and seeing his good qualities. And as he did that, then the energy to overeat began to fade away, because there was some contentment in his mind about who he was. And, you know, he developed some self-respect. And he lost that weight. He became a dietitian with Kaiser Permanente. And, you know, he kept the weight off the rest of his life, and is eating very, very healthily.
What's the reaction that you're receiving to this book, which, you know, is probably different, but maybe not so far removed from what you share in your other books in terms of philosophies?
Yeah, the reaction's been good. You know, the people have been very interested in it. The publisher especially, I was a little bit surprised, actually, how interested the publisher was in this book, because they've really promoted it. So they see something, you know, that is a need in society that the book fulfills. So we've had a very good response to this.
I would imagine that visitors to the Abbey, people who come on retreat as well, will find that book very useful to take home with them.
Yes. But it's meant not only for the visitors, but, you know, for to the Abbey, but for everybody.
Yes. So let's talk about some of the other things that the Abbey does and other resources that you offer to people. I mean, you've done a lot of work in the community. You've done work in prisons. You've done work with homeless teenagers, etc. Tell us about some of the outreach that you do in the community.
First of well, part of our philosophy is, you know, to cultivate love and loving kindness and compassion in our own hearts, but then also to show them, you know, and to be of service to society. So, for example, with the prison work, I never intended, again, another thing I never intended to do, but one day I got a letter from somebody in a federal prison in Ohio asking, you know, for Buddhist resources and having questions about Buddhism. So we started corresponding. I didn't think twice about answering his letter. There wasn't a thing of, oh no, there's a prisoner who's writing me, it's dangerous. There wasn't that thought, because I've taken precepts to, you know, when people ask for help, to do whatever I can to be of service to them. So I saw, yeah, I can send this guy some books, I can answer his questions. And then he began to tell other people that he knew in prison, and the word kind of spread, and then other prison groups contacted us, and then pretty soon, you know, it just developed organically. And now we correspond with, there's over 1,000 inmates in our database. We send them books, we send them materials. We do a retreat every year that we invite them to join, even though they're meditating in prison. And I go on and do talks in prisons, prison visits, and other people in the Abbey do. And it's a program that just developed very naturally, and it's so rewarding, because these are people that society has thrown away. They just say, oh, somebody's a criminal. They give them the label criminal, so sign them off. They're worthless. And that's not true at all, you know. These people have talents. They have interests. They have feelings. And through our work, we can really see some of the people change and develop, you know, to think about their lives, to think about what is valuable. It's very, very rewarding to see this. And also, we've learned a lot through this, and there's a lot of discussion now in the press about prison reform, and I really see the value in this, because by talking to guys who are living in prison, I've really come to see what the system is like and how much it needs improvement. You know, our criminal justice system is not just. Yeah, we need to do better than this. With the work with the homeless teens, again, somebody in the local community came to talk to us one day about, you know, they were doing work with homeless teens, and we just said, wow, we want to help. Because I know as a teenager myself, I was quite confused, and I can't imagine being not having a stable living situation as a kid, you know, especially because your body's changing, your mind is confused, and if you don't have a stable living situation and adults around you that you can trust, I mean, it's horrible. And for the kids now, and it sets them up for acting out and for having very difficult lives as adults. So we wanted to help with that and, you know, help provide services to the kids. We get a lot of requests from different places in the community when hospitals are having an in-service about helping the dying. They often ask us to come to present the Buddhist viewpoint on death and dying and how to help the dying. We get requests. Last night I was at a synagogue. They had a, you know, as part of their youth group where they want the kids to learn about different religions. I was invited to come and speak. We have all sorts of people in the community calling and asking us to come speak and to share ideas. And they find it very, very helpful. So we love doing that ourselves. Yeah.
You have an online education program. You also have thousands of teachings on YouTube, and you're very active on social media. You have two websites full of Dharma materials. Again, all of this freely offered. How are you supported? I mean, when you go out and you do talks, do people make donations? Do you get paid for the works, the lectures, etc.? Because there has to be something coming in to support the expense of your generosity.
You can't live on air and water.
Yeah.
We do everything free of charge. Because like I said, we want to live a life of generosity. And people reciprocate. So when people, invite one of us, to go and teach, they cover the transportation costs. They do all the arrangements, and then they usually give a donation. We don't stipulate the amount of the donation. Again, it's this thing of whatever people want to give, we accept with gratitude. And that's it. And so often, people just give the donations, and I take the envelopes back to the Abbey. I don't look inside and say, oh, who gave so much and who gave this much and who gave that much, because I don't want to, I want to be able to go and travel and teach to the places where I feel the people are the most sincere and not have to think about, where did they give the biggest donations? Because if I think like that, then my own mind gets corrupted.
Yes.
Okay, so I just think about, where are the people, where do they need the Dharma most? Where are they, the most sincere and the most eager to receive the teachings? And the amount of donation doesn't matter. But again, I think when you live your life like this, then people reciprocate. And, at the very beginning, when we first moved into the Abbey, the original residents were me and two cats. And I remember sitting here, like you said at the beginning of the interview, I was sitting here and wondering how in the world are we going to pay off this mortgage, because I ordained when I was 26. I had never owned a house or a car. I had always been very frugal because I started supporting myself when I was 18. And I was saying, how are we going to pay off this mortgage? And then I just, said, okay, we have our values and principles. We're going to live this way, and we'll see what happens. And, and people support what we do. So, and it's wonderful that we can keep going in this way.
Well, I think,
In short, everything's by donation basis. That's the best way to put it.
There is a wonderful saying, virtue is its own reward. And clearly, what you're giving out to the world, you're getting back. And being supported, it becomes this beautiful flow, doesn't it? You give and others give in return, and that allows you to give more. In our last few moments, we've probably got about 3 minutes left. I want to touch upon something that I read. I was reading some interviews with you, and you talked about how, everything you've spoken about today really is teaching us about the importance of cultivating compassion and generosity. And you mentioned the words in this particular interview, and subduing anger in order to improve our relationships and create peace in society. You then went on to talk about ethical behaviour and that we cannot separate the way the government operates from ethical behaviour. This, of course, applies to all governments. What we're witnessing today in so many countries and cultures falls way, way short of being ethical. How do Buddhists respond to that? How do we as individuals cope with that? And what can we personally do to change it?
Whoa. Yeah, I think about this a lot. I think the first thing we need to do is, as individuals, get our own ethical conduct in shape. Yeah, because accusing people in government of doing things that we ourselves do, that's quite hypocritical. So to really work on our own ethical conduct. And then when we see things that are not fair, that are not just, to speak up, to say something, to not just say, oh, well, you know, that doesn't pertain to me, or other people will take care of it, or whatever. It, you know, it's really our responsibility as citizens, I think, to speak up when the government is doing harmful things, or when companies are doing harmful things, when they're putting out products that are not tested well enough, or, you know, in the case of the opioid crisis, advertising things that they know are addictive, you know, to doctors and to consumers. So I think it's important that we speak up about these kinds of things in the press, and to, you know, put pressure on companies and really, you know, we live in this world and we need to take care of it, and we need to take care of each other, because if we don't take care of each other, then we're going to live in a world with a lot of unhappy people. And when other people are unhappy, they're going to make our lives miserable. So the Dalai Lama says, if you want to be selfish, be wisely selfish and take care of others. Because if we care for others, we're going to be a lot happier ourselves. But of course, we also want to care for others, because they're living beings, and just like us, who want happiness and don't want suffering. So I think our civil rights in this country, our right to vote, our right of assembly, our right, you know, a free press, these kinds of things are quite important. I also think that tech companies have a responsibility to really think about what the effects of their actions are. And scientists have this responsibility too, because it's not just, you know, oh, this is such an interesting thing to research, or such an interesting thing to puzzle to solve and see if we can create technology that will do this, that, and the other thing. But to think of what the repercussions on society are going to be, because we're now seeing, you know, we thought the tech revolution was fantastic, we're all going to be interconnected now, but now we're seeing that, you know, is also enhancing the power of white nationalism.
Yeah.
It's, you know, with face recognition, you know, will we still have privacy? The way the, you know, our political opinions are able to be swayed by fake news and false messages put on by, you know, other governments who want to affect our elections. So we really need to think about the technology and how it can be used.
Okay, I'm sorry. We're going to have to end it there. I think we've gone over. Venerable Thupten Chodron, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Sandy.
Thank you. The Compassionate Kitchen, Buddhist Practices for Eating with Mindfulness and Gratitude, published by Shambhala Publications. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. Thanks for joining us today, and we'll be back next week.